Hello, welcome to Converging Dialogues. This is Xavier Bonilla. On this episode, I'm very happy to bring the conversation I had with Robert Traeger. Robert is professor of political science at the University of California in Los Angeles and international governance lead at the Center for the Governance of AI. He's an expert in international governance of emerging technologies, diplomatic practice, and institutional design. He's written a handful of books, numerous articles that have been in many science journals. He's been published in places like the New York Times, The Economist, Financial Times, Washington Post, NPR, and many other outlets. From 2017 to 2021, he was the assistant director for research for the Berkeley Center for International Relations. He's been at the University of Oxford and Yale University, and also at Harvard. So he's quite established. And he is the man to go to about governance on AI systems. And that's what we talk about in this conversation. We start by talking about why do we care about AI questions? You know, obviously it's more, in vogue. People are talking about it. So we're trying to get at this piece of it in the beginning of why do we care about this? What's the skin in the game for all of us of sorts? We sort of define intelligence and then the difference for machine learning. And then we give the current landscape of AI systems currently being built and what that looks like. You know, it's so massive. There's in so many, fields and disciplines. And so we kind of try to break down what that looks like. We talk about why ethics and governance are needed for AI systems and what those differences are. We talk about other governance models and the uniqueness of the AI problem. We talk about this kind of frustrating puzzle of sorts of how do we control the creativity of AI? Something that's different from, let's say, nuclear weapons. You know, AI is, if you're building machines to get better and better and better, well, they're going to get better and better and better on their own of sorts, right? That's that kind of artificial intelligence, which is, different from, just building a weapon or something else. We talk about civilian AI, military AI, how to enforce rules with military AI, the alignment problem. And then ways we should talk about AI in public life. So this was such a fabulous conversation, and that there's a bit in the conversation where, I really kind of pushed back a little bit on Robert, not in a disagreeing way. I think we both agree, but really try to flush out this problem of creativity and always changing with AI, which is like just different. And how to regulate that. And it's just so difficult. Again, folks like Robert are right on the front lines of this stuff. They're doing absolutely fantastic work. He's brilliant. He's got such a great voice on these topics, and he's just wonderful to kind of follow in this space. As always, you can find this podcast and all other conversations I've had on the podcast at Converging Dialogues at Substack.com. I'm also on YouTube, so subscribe, follow, contribute, share with your friends. Always means a lot. And make sure you follow Robert's work. And now I bring you Robert Traeger. I am here with Robert Traeger. Robert, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm greatly looking forward to talking with you.
Xavier, it's great to be here. Nice to meet you, and thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been very excited to talk with you about a handful of things. Mostly, I think we'll spend our time in the very, very continually salient topic of AI, AI systems, machine learning, etc. And so, I think we can hit on a few big topics that I think are super important for that. Before we do, why don't you tell listeners who you are, both professionally, academically, and what you currently spend most of your time doing in that space?
Well, I'm starting an institute at the University of Oxford called the AI Governance Initiative at the Martin School there. And I'm directing that alongside somebody called Mike Osborne, who is in the Department of Engineering Sciences and is a machine learning researcher. And my background is in social science and policy. I was for many years a professor at UCLA in the political science department there. And now I'm based in the School of Government at Oxford. And well, what am I doing and thinking about? It's mostly AI governance these days, particularly international AI governance, particularly thinking about what international regimes should look like, but really all aspects, both technical and governance aspects of AI governance. We have a set of research projects on that we're working on, and starting up this institute. Those are the things that get most of my time, at least professionally.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. We're going to get on to the international governance piece of it. I guess I just want to start with kind of like a kind of fun question to start with, kind of in the beginning, is obviously, like many things, the topic of AI, machine learning, has become in vogue. Many people are talking about this. Many people are talking about it from different angles. Maybe this will come out later, but I guess I just want to start with, is AI systems something that we should be worried about? Many people will say, absolutely, it's going to be the death of humanity. I think this is the Stephen Hawking forecast. And other people will be like, oh, it's fine. You know, it's just a new thing, new technology. We adapt. You don't have to necessarily pick a side necessarily here, but I'm sure you've heard this kind of way of talking about these issues when it comes to AI. I guess, what do you feel is a realistic way or a healthy way of kind of thinking about risks or benefits of AI systems as we keep pushing further in the 21st century here?
Well, I think, you know, this is an area where a lot of people seem to disagree at first, but actually when you sort of talk to people, that everybody really agrees that there are a whole lot of potential benefits and there are a set of risks associated with the technology. And those risks are both threats to public safety because this technology is democratizing the ability to do all sorts of things. And some things that sound more like science fiction are possibilities, for instance, loss of control of the technology so that it starts doing something and is, you know, quite powerful, potentially even relatively general at doing things, and is hard to control. And that those things are a possibility. And then there's a whole other set of risks that, you know, there's just lots of other sets of risks, really, is what you should say. There are risks that relate to, for instance, bias and people understanding why some decisions that affect their lives are being made. When they go in to get a bank loan, you know, they may be denied for that loan, and it may be on the basis of a system, and nobody really understands that system. Nobody really knows why that decision was made, and maybe it was something that, you know, we wouldn't want being the basis of a decision. There are just all these different aspects of this incredibly powerful set of technologies that's emerging now. And I think, you know, I would really like to see people, instead of fighting about which risks are the most significant, I would just like to see us addressing all of these risks.
I'm terribly pragmatic. So I like when people offer solutions or avenues of how to mitigate some risks or live with or manage other ones. And I think sensationalizing things doesn't help very, very much. So let's start with some terms real quick. Again, I've said this before. I really hate when people, you know, kind of get bogged down in definitions. I don't really care. I'll use your definitions. I'm not married to one or the other. But I guess one thing we should probably define at the outset is, what is artificial intelligence? You can break that up if you want to try and take a stab at defining intelligence. Again, social scientists continue to argue about this for humans and other species and the artificial piece. And probably a little bit more important here is this distinction between AI, of how we think about it, in one way, AI systems, and machine learning, because my understanding is there's somewhat of a difference there. So maybe just kind of give us some operational definitions for some of these important terms we'll kind of be mentioning here.
Yeah, so artificial intelligence is famously difficult to define, and I don't really get super into the weeds here myself. So I think I'll just offer a kind of very intuitive way of thinking about it. And that's really it's really a very broad term. And when we talk about artificial intelligence, we're talking about systems that are able to perform tasks that are normally associated with human intelligence. And, you know, what exactly is intelligence? And, you know, how should we think about it? I think, you know, those are really interesting and fraught questions. I'm not sure I'm necessarily the best person to talk about them off the cuff. But, you know, I think the main thing probably for the purposes of our discussion is just to think about artificial intelligence as this kind of broad category of doing human intelligency-like things, but in an artificial system. And then you asked about machine learning. And in that case, it really is what it sounds like. It's machines learning things. So machines being intelligent, but not just an intelligence that is all the stuff that, you know, some human said, you know, these are the things that you need to know, machine, and kind of put them in. That was sort of the model of the early days of artificial intelligence. But now with machine learning, the machines are learning things that aren't directly being put in there by the human. They're figuring those things out from data and from simulation. That's what we think of as kind of a broad class of machine learning. And that's been very, very powerful. Those techniques have been very, very powerful, much more powerful, it turns out, for many applications than actually a human being trying to sort of hard code a set of facts and ideas and relationships into the computer.
So, you know, kind of with that, you know, I feel like anytime there's a new technology that's developed, people will have a lot of ideas. And sometimes we learn these things by accident. And sometimes we can't afford that. So a very, you know, kind of nominal example here is something like, you know, the radio or the television or something like that. And of course, they can have some be used terribly. A more extreme example of that would be something like the nuclear bomb. Much different. The internet's probably another example, but then you see social media that has many kind of this, you know, it has provided a very rapid, as a rapid vehicle for misinformation and disinformation. And that wasn't its intention, but that's how it's used. So we kind of find these things out. And I guess along those lines, the thing that always interests me, is really the ethics of AI systems, and so, you know, and we'll talk about it later, the alignment problem and things like that. But I guess currently, what is the kind of current landscape of where companies are with developing AI? You know, what systems and or organizations are currently overseeing AI, right? Because I have to imagine there's, you know, this is kind of getting to the kind of crux of what you do is there's this international thing, but how do you set rules or regulations or standards internationally when you have different companies that are private or you have different nation states, you have different governments? How is there like a sort of uniformity for international regulations there? So kind of just tell us what the landscape is of people developing AI and kind of sort of how is that moving or shaping these kind of international governance pieces?
Yeah. Okay. Let me do a quick stab at landscape and then a quick stab at sort of international governance. And you can tell me where you'd sort of like to go from there. So, So thinking about, thinking about AI, you know, AI is such a broad term and there's so many aspects of it. So maybe we should confine ourselves to sort of what's sometimes called frontier AI, maybe the more general systems or the systems which are kind of at the cutting edge and often require these large amounts of compute to train them. And if we're thinking about that, there are three companies that people are often pointing to as being at the forefront there, those being Google DeepMind, OpenAI, and Anthropic. Those companies are doing some extraordinary things on the cutting edge of these technologies. And then there's a huge landscape of others that are out there, both internationally and in the United States. And you know, it's unclear how this big landscape of companies are really going to shake out. I mean, for instance, there's a company called Inflection AI, which is developing agents. And that's one of the founders of DeepMind, who's involved with that, as well as another well-known person in the technology space who founded that together. And so, you know, they're getting access to large amounts of compute. They're training some models to be sort of personal agents for people to be assistants, really, for people. But personalized assistants is sort of their business model. And there are lots of companies that are doing things like this. And internationally, there are companies, and in some cases, companies associated with states, who are developing general purpose models, often sort of following in the footsteps of GPT-4 from OpenAI. There's so many specific aspects of this. In most cases, models at the cutting edge are using these computer chips from a relatively small or narrow supply chain. So that's a key aspect of the governance landscape. And it's unclear if that narrowness is going to persist over time or not. And of course, there are the export restrictions that the United States, along with some of its allies, have put on the global flow of this hardware. And that, of course, has the effect of encouraging development of similar technologies elsewhere. So many people think that it's really hard to reconstitute those supply chains. But of course, on a longer time scale, it's not impossible. And it's also unclear on a short time scale, as we have algorithmic improvements, as we have improvements in chip technologies also elsewhere, how this all nets out in terms of what the capabilities of different actors internationally really are right now and will be a year from now and will be a couple of years from now. So these are all sort of some of the uncertainties that we have right now, but that's an attempt to sort of give you a very brief overview of the space. And then
let me jump in there. Let me ask, what is it? It seems that so you mentioned these kind of like big three companies that are developing a lot of the AI, frontier AI systems, as you're saying. Is it kind of like a sort of, I don't want to say trickle down kind of effect, but a kind of downstream effect, however you want to describe it, of, well, if these big three or really big companies kind of get on board with some of the regulations or some of the parameters that we're setting, they're working with all of these, you know, kind of international, you know, programs or nation states, that there's a kind of like almost like a, you know, unspoken kind of like, okay, if DeepMind's doing it, then all the other companies, well, okay, we'll follow along and do it as well. Is it sort of kind of laying out that way, or is it more literally everyone's just doing their own thing? And, you know, how maybe it's not that cut and dry, but is there some kind of unwritten thing about that, or no?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, we're sort of figuring out all those things right now. And I can't say that I've been in every room, so I don't necessarily know every single thing that's happened, but I think there's some of that, but I wouldn't want to exaggerate it, is my impression.
Okay.
So what I mean by that, there's some of it on the side of You know, the companies that are big companies that are going to be interacting with governments and with potential regulators over time, they don't want to look like the bad guy, right?
Yeah.
So if one of the others is being really cooperative and says, oh yeah, you can have all the model access that you want and, you know, whatever you need, you know, we're going to do it, then the other guys tend to go along with that, or at least feel some pressure, I think, guess. Again, you know, I'm not in every room, but it seems to me that that's what happens. But again, I don't want to exaggerate, you know, the sort of virtuous aspects of this, because I also think that these firms are figuring out, you know, how much they want to go along with, what they want to push back against. I think, you know, if there are a set of firms that look like they're being really responsible and doing everything that's asked of them, there's probably a niche for some other firms to not do everything that's asked of them. And maybe they exist in a different jurisdiction and they have a somewhat different set of incentives. So, you know, you can imagine that something like a reputation for being really responsible and safe is something that, you know, we have that, like, you know, probably Volvo has like a reputation for safety in the car space, right? And so maybe one of these companies will develop a reputation like that. Maybe a couple of them will, but it probably can't be the brand for everyone. So I think, and that's just one way of understanding that there are some different niches that I think will be occupied by different actors in the space.
Yeah. Well, I guess it depends. Is it, you know, Volvo pre-Ford buyout or Volvo post? I'm just kidding. Volvo's great. So about international governance of AI systems, so really kind of getting to the core of what you work at, you know, this seems like it's still very much in its infancy. And I want to know, I mean, there's a lot of things to kind of unfold here. I guess the first, you can talk about what that looks like or what that is, but where, when you're talking about not incentives, but like the motivation here, is this coming from outside groups saying, wait a minute, let's not have a kind of Westworld situation here. Let's get ahead of this before we get there. Or is it kind of due diligence that certain companies or certain, again, governments are saying, let's get this together and figure this out before we have a really catastrophic, you know, accident? I guess what's the kind of movement behind international governance? Or are people just like, y'all are the annoying people telling me what I can and can't do and rules? And, like, you know, most people have an aversion to that. So what's the kind of genesis or motivating factors here of pushing for this kind of governance of AI systems?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So I think there are a number of different sides to it. So one is, you know, I think you can see it with the AI Safety Summit that we had a little over a month ago. And this was a moment when a lot of prominent people in industry and in governments around the world got together and they released a statement, they released a couple of statements saying that these developing systems pose very significant risks, including potentially to the future of humanity. So that's quite a bracing thing to say. And in a way, what they did was they agreed on the need for some global rules of the game. But what they didn't do is really talk about what those rules should be or how we should have some kind of international or create some kind of international regime to make those rules real. So that's where we are. We're trying to figure out how to do that. We've had a lot of statements of principle in terms of what do we want from these advanced AI systems. But in terms of turning those principles into actual something in the direction, let's say, of regulation or even in a set of international standards or some sort of governance. It's unclear exactly what that should look like, but some sort of governance. And there, I think we're still working. We're still working. I don't think we have all the answers. I think somebody said recently that we're going to have to walk through the water and feel the stones under our feet as we figure this out.
Jeez.
in other words, we have a lot of work to do. I think to figure that out.
This reminds me a little bit of I had Matthew Cobb on earlier this year, and he wrote a book As Gods, where he talks about kind of the history of genetics. And there was in the 70s when they were making these breakthroughs, there would be these big conferences and scientists would say, we can't clone people. We all agree on that. And everyone agreed on principle. And then people just like never did anything with it. And they just like, you know, we've cloned animals at this point. And I think there's been some pretty spurious activity for humans or other things. And so it's like, you know, it sounds like a lot of these people, it's like, you know, maybe a good PR thing where it's like, yeah, in principle, we agree, but I guarantee you, those same people, you come with a set of international kind of rules and regulations, they're going to be like, no, we're not doing this. Or, I don't know, how could we get around this? Or, so it's nice in principle. It's a good start. But are there people that are resisting this, even at this level of in principle? Like, look, let's just full creativity. Don't hamper us, you know. Are there people kind of against this? Is that like a minority or what's the kind of pulse there?
So many things to say. so there are lots of people who are against some of these ideas moving in some governance directions. So on the one hand, you have people who say, oh, it could stifle innovation. You know, maybe having a bunch of regulations can stifle innovation. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks who are worried about that. Then you have people who are in the global, let's say the global south, as it's sometimes called, who say, wait a minute, you know, if we have a set of global regulations, doesn't that just sound like things that are going to make it more difficult for us to develop and catch up to where others are in this technology? And they're worried about that. Then you have a set of people that are worried about industry capture. And they think that, well, if you have a bunch of regulations, you know, the really large companies, they can do that. They can comply with an onerous set of regulations, but the smaller companies can't. And so you're just kind of putting up a barrier and you're entrenching monopolies. And they're really worried about that, the concentration of technology power. So yeah, there are worries from a number of different angles, and it's not just those angles. There are worries, I think, from a lot of different angles, and a lot of people just think, oh, you know, I think the risks are these things, and you know, regulation seems to be worried about a different set of risks, and so there's this question of what to prioritize. That's a very fraught question too. So, so we don't have agreement on all these things. We still have a lot of discussing to do, and we probably need governance from many different angles. You know, you were mentioning the Asilomar regime that operates at the kind of subnational level of the field of recombinant DNA. And, you know, that's a controversial regime too. Some people think that's been reasonably effective. Some people think it hasn't been effective. And it certainly hasn't been perfectly effective, as you were pointing out. But, you know, is the world maybe a little bit better because it exists? Well, you know, it's harder to argue against.
Depends on who you ask.
It's hard to argue against that. You know, it might not be true, but it, you know, it's hard to know because, you know, we just have one sample of history. And so making that counterfactual case is difficult. But, you know, so I think there's a good chance that norms, professional norms like that, they can do something. They can do things. They can make the world better. But probably they're not enough if there are big incentives to violate those professional norms and big consequences for the rest of us when those norms are violated. So we probably want to think about what else we can do.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Of course. I mean, I'm by nature a proactive person. So yeah, rules and regulations are annoying sometimes, but I mean, I definitely don't want to find out, especially when, you know, it does, there's certain similarities with like the climate change issue where it's like, you know, people go to, you know, COP15 and COP whatever, and they're just like, yeah, you know, reduce, you know, by two degrees or whatever. And everyone signs and everyone agrees except for like three countries. And then, you know, China and India are governments. I should be clear on that. China, India governments are like, yeah, whatever. It's just like, okay, well, like we gotta, when are we going to be able to actually do this? And so it's, and I'm not saying that they haven't done anything. It's, you know, it's obviously not enough. So, yeah, I mean, I think that becomes difficult.
Well, I would just say that Xavi, I don't know if this is the time or the place, but I would just say that we do have international regimes that are pretty effective at doing stuff. So, you know, if you think about a civil aviation or something like that, you know, that again, it's not perfect. There are lots of critiques to be made, but in terms of over time improving the safety assurance provision in this industry, it's extraordinary. We have a pretty safe aviation industry around the world. And this international regime looks like it really has a lot to do with that. And there are some incentives to comply with the standards, with international standards. That's something we can get into. And it, you know, it's not just there, but you know, also on things like money laundering, you know, there's a regime and there are incentives to comply with those standards. And in the maritime space, there's International Maritime Organization and there are incentives to comply with those standards. So there are models out there where we're able to incentivize the sort of things that we want to see. None of them are perfect, but we can do some good anyway.
I certainly want to come to, you know, already kind of models we have for other departments. I think there's some differences. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that. I did have one kind of, I guess, clarifying question of sorts is, international governance of these things and setting up norms and standards, how is that similar and dissimilar from the ethical questions of AI systems? So many people will talk about the ethics of AI, you know, kind of the, tired example now is, you know, the self-driving car that has two people in it and, you know, an old woman walks across the street. Does, you know, the car save the person in the street or the people in the car? What's in, you know, who's writing that code to say, you know, which one it is, and does the code work? And, you know, at certain points, who's making these choices? And, you know, those are kind of ethical questions. There are plenty of other ones too, in terms of like, we'll get into this later, but, you know, military AI, a lot of ethics around that. But is this kind of rules and regulations just kind of like aware of some of the ethical problems and questions, but not necessarily trying to impose that directly into like rules and regulations? Like, just tell us what's that kind of, where's the overlap, the similarities between the governance and AI or the ethics, excuse me, and where's it, I guess, different?
The difference between the sort of ethics and the governance.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there are different ways you could think about that. I tend to think about the ethics of AI as at the level of general principle. You know, we want to say things like if a system is making a decision about someone's life, there should be certain sorts of transparency into how that decision was made. That's an ethical principle. And then the question becomes, how do we actually operationalize that ethical principle in standards and sometimes in law? And so the governance is kind of getting in. Usually I think about the governance is the details and the ethics is the general principle. I don't think it always has to be thought of in that way, but often you think of it in that way. And you know, part of the issue is that people don't actually agree about the ethics, even at the level of general principle, there is disagreement. And once you start talking about the nitty-gritty, and you know, you might, even if you did agree on the general principle, you often disagree in terms of implementation, because there are different modes of implementation and they have differing implications for whose interests are forwarded and opposed. So often, particularly internationally, you know, there's a lot of discussion at the level of principle, because it turns out to be just much easier to get agreement at the level of principle. But at the level of what should we do concretely, there's a ton of disagreement. And and the transition from talking about the one to talking about the other is very fraught. And that is exactly at the moment where we are now. We have a raft of international statements of principles. But what should we do concretely? That's not only don't we really know exactly, it's even hard to have those conversations, because I think many actors are worried about engaging in a conversation that they're not quite sure where it's going to end up.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to the question I had about that you were just referencing a bit ago about what are some other models that we have that we can look to? In one of your papers, you had a nice chart detailing some of this that, you know, have international governance for various systems. So examples of this, you know, it's a bunch of alphabet soup, but, you know, IAEA, IAIO, IPCC, CERN.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of ones, you know, these are for nuclear. These are for, I think the CERN is for physics or whatever it is. There's one for aviation. There's some, you know, maritime, some of the ones you listed earlier.
Yeah.
Where we have this already. So what could we, two questions. What could we pull from models we have for, you know, international regulations already for some important things like, you know, flying and nuclear energy or weapons? Second, though, to that is, it feels like, in my opinion, that in a way, AI is different than any of those things. Because with AI, you're unlocking, there's such a, one of the central ingredients it seems to be with AI is creativity, is autonomy, which is, you know, we talk about AI with sentience and consciousness and things like that, that is very analogous or somewhat a type of surrogacy of sorts of what it is to be human. Nuclear weapons don't have that. Airplanes don't have that. Right, they can be autonomous in a certain way, but it's not the same thing. And I wonder if this is part of, like, yes, there are models, there are organizations that are or have been, you know, good to have as a framework. They're not perfect, obviously, but I wonder if the AI component with the creativity, with the kind of human-like adjacent qualities to it or potential for that is what makes it super challenging and super difficult to find regulations on that. So yes, those two questions.
I like it. Different parts of the question. So I guess I'll start just say, you know, we have all these models and all these models do different things, you know? So you have like IPCC. So this is in the climate change area. What does IPCC do? It's a UN organization. It basically produces reports about once every 5 years, at least 5 years. When it does produce a report, it's a big report. You know, it's the kind of thing you could heave like over the top of a portcullis, you know, to somebody down below. You wanted to hurt them. Okay. That's right, what we're talking about. And that's a problem when it comes to AI, because AI, to your point, is developing really rapidly. And probably, you know, we need to be figuring out what the risks are and consensing on things much more quickly than every 5 years. Can you imagine, you know, what we'd be saying, you know, 5 years ago? My God, it'd be totally different. We'd be irrelevant for the world of, of today. Mm-hmm. So, so I think, you know, an IPCC is something that we sort of have now a little bit, because the that is in the AI space. We have a little bit because there's the State of the Science report that was set up at the AI summit led by Yoshua Bengio, who I think understands the urgency and wants to put out things that are quicker. And so that's one of the places that I think we'll see an opportunity to converge on what some of these risks may be. So that's an IPCC. And then, you know, you have things like a CERN, which is maybe an opportunity to have a collaborative research project. What should that research project be? You know, some people say, oh, wouldn't it be great if the whole world just got together and built really powerful AI systems together? So that's one idea that some people have. Another idea is, well, you know, if there are things that we need to do to make these systems safe, then maybe that should be the worldwide research project. So then you have like a CERN for AI safety. That's another idea. And then a lot of people talk about an IAEA. And I think in this case, you know, they're often thinking about having some kind of global regulator. And they're sort of forgetting that, you know, the IAEA doesn't do that much with regulating the major nuclear powers. It's enforcing the non-proliferation regime on all the other powers. So they sort of conveniently forget that when they're talking about the IAEA. But they do have this sort of idea that maybe we need a global regulator of some kind. And then, you know, we have talked about another approach, thinking about jurisdictional certification, which is similar to what goes on in some other industries, like civil aviation, and we mentioned a few other industries, including maritime and money laundering, have these regimes where there's an international organization. It's not auditing firms. That's the thing. It's not like you have the civilian aviation organization that's going into American Airlines and British Airways and just like rooting around and figuring out what they're doing. It's not what happens. Mm-hmm. What these organizations do is they audit the state regulatory systems to see that they have appropriate regulation, and in some cases to check that they're effectively enforcing that appropriate regulation. And so, you know, that would be a different model, one we could talk about in terms of the incentives to comply or not. Now, let's see, the second part of your question.
Yeah, that one, that's a tough one, right? I mean, it's the creativity piece of it. I mean, yes, the climate is super important. Yes, nuclear weapons and or, you know, energy is super important. But we're not, or I guess we are in some ways, but it's different. Like, we're not building things. Like, we know what nuclear energy is. We know what, you know, Oppenheimer, you know, broke that for us and we figured it out and we make bombs and, you know, where we could make bombs, you know, the planet is the planet. And, you know, we have to make sure that we don't continue to like destroy it more. Okay, cool. So, you know, so on and so forth, things that are, you know, need to be regulated. This is something that, like you mentioned, is so in flux. And, you know, you have so many smart brains out there that are like creating more and refining it. And we're talking now about AI that could be sentient or conscious. Now, I'm not saying that's right there right away, but the fact that that's in the conversation, we're not talking about sentient airplanes or, you know, nuclear bombs that can, you know, get up and walk around. Like, this just feels, those things are all valid, I think, with those systems, but this just seems different. And I'm not saying that because, like, you know, I'm talking to you here or whatever. Like, it just, it feels like a different problem.
Yeah.
What do we do with that kind of, like, you know, always hot variable, like, you know, very much in play?
Yeah. Well, so I think the essence of your question is, you know, what is it that's different about this technology that maybe means we need some different models of governance to deal with it? And I think that's exactly the right question. I don't think we have, you know, the perfect model out there. We can draw from different things that we have, but I don't think we have the perfect thing. But maybe one way of understanding what's different, to your points, is to say that this is a technology, the consequences of which might be more significant to the planet than other technologies. And, you know, we don't need to make it like a horse race between, you know, nuclear technology and AI or something like that. You know, in a way, I think it's like the dawn of the nuclear era, probably, because in that was a moment when everybody realized that something new was happening and it, you know, needed to be dealt with. And maybe at the international level, there needed to be some new institutions. And, you know, philosophers like Bertrand Russell were writing books called Will Man Survive? And, you know, physicists were quoting the Bhagavad Gita and you know, and so on. And one of the interesting things is, you know, that was a moment when people, an enormous amount of thought went into trying to figure out, could we have some sort of governance arrangement that would actually make us safe from nuclear weapons? Could we do that? And we don't have that, in spite of an enormous amount of human effort devoted to that. We don't have that. And, you know, if you wanted, though, to have a worldwide arrangement in which there were zero nuclear weapons, you know, I think we have a reasonable idea of, you know, what that would have to look like. Right, you know, people have thought about all kinds of details, like how long would it take to break out? You know, that's this term of art where you're, you know, how long would it take some state that wanted to develop nuclear weapons in secret to actually do that? And what would be the likelihood of the other states discovering that it was doing that and being able to stop it during that time? You know, so you would. And it would be a big deal, right, to be sure that you could. Because if you were going to transition to a world where you didn't have any defense against it, you'd be putting a huge amount of faith in that international regime. You know, compare, I'm going to bring this back to AI in just one second, but okay, yeah. But compare these two different types of regimes. The kind of regime that we have now, where the US and Russia agree that they're not going to have more than a certain number of deployed nuclear warheads. But what they have deployed right now is enough to, you know, obviously destroy the world many times over. So if the point is, if one of the sides were to cheat and build some more weapons, you know, how big a deal would that be? The other side would still have a nuclear deterrent. You know, I don't want to get in trouble with, you know, the people I know in nuclear security who would say, oh, yeah, that would be a huge deal and that'd be a bit, you know, all this. But the fact is that if you compare that, how big a deal it would be to the case where everybody has zero nuclear weapons. And then somebody cheats and builds the same number that we were talking about in the case where people have a lot of nuclear weapons. In that case, it's a way bigger deal, right? So think about the different sort of arrangements and regimes that you need in the one world versus in the other world. And in a way, I think what some people are saying now is that for advanced AI, we need to have the sort of regime that you would need to have zero nuclear weapons. So, in other words, if you wanted a world in which you're going to prevent any failure, you're not going to tolerate a single failure of the rules of the international regime. We don't have a lot of international agreements like that. Most of them are designed just like criminal laws are designed. We expect them to be broken sometimes. But if you wanted a regime where it was never going to be broken, that would be a different sort of challenge. And it would be on the order of the challenge of creating a world with zero nuclear weapons, which, by the way, has been taken seriously by serious people. You know, Henry Kissinger and Sam Nunn and other people writing op-eds in the Wall Street Journal about possibilities here. So it's, you know, it's not that people who are really experienced in these areas haven't thought about these things and taken them seriously, but it's also telling that it hasn't happened and would be a real challenge.
So I hear everything you're saying, and I don't disagree with any of that. I still have this question in my head of, I just think it's different because, okay, let me maybe backtrack a bit. I had Carl Robichaud on the podcast, and we had a great conversation about nuclear. He told me in the conversation at some point about, I think some of what you're alluding to maybe is this creation of like a nuclear taboo. And that's what really keeps the world a little bit more on even keel of sorts. You know, the fact that there's only 9 countries that have nuclear, active nuclear weapons. You know, there's, what did he told me? There's like probably 30 that are anywhere in between, could tomorrow be a 10th or 11th country, and anywhere where it's like just starting, but whatever, we'll just leave it aside. There's 9 countries. Yeah, this nuclear taboo, that's why Japan doesn't develop any. It's why Germany doesn't develop any. That's why we haven't done any tests outside of North Korea, et cetera. And that's great. I think that's great. He actually said it's a marvel that in 80 years or whatever, we haven't had another strike, you know, which is thankfully that hasn't happened. I think about it like in this sense. If you take something like it's not even, I guess it's a type of AI system, right? I mean, it's more machine learning. When you take something like my YouTube algorithm, right? When I get down those like, you know, dark rabbit holes one night and I'm just like, why am I looking about the rarest tiger, the, you know, the last known, you know, animal that was, you know, maybe it's not extinct, or I'm looking at, you know, people doing, you know, crazy parkour off big buildings, and they're like very, you know, whatever I'm looking at. And I just like, I'm not planning on looking at this, right? And then the next days, you know, after that, all of my suggestions on my YouTube are just videos of the same things I was looking at that night, right? There's a kind of in vivo thing that's happening where the algorithm, the type of, you know, machine learning is trying to know with the user what you like, what your affinities are, what you're looking for. And when you're looking at that with various AI systems where we want it so good, right? I'm going to show my age here for maybe a younger audience. Like, I can remember before there was internet, obviously, but I can remember now where when you had to do a Google search, like it will even brag about it, right? It will type in and see how well can it guess what your question is going to be in Google, right? And it took like 0.00 whatever seconds to like get all the results that you want, right? Now, granted, the Google search is doing like 10% sweep of the actual internet, but whatever, right? That's all I care about. I want my answer. I don't want to look at the dark web and all that to find my answer. I just want my answer. So we kind of buy into that filter. But it's one of those things where it's like, I just think that I hear everything you're saying about the nuclear example. I just see this as so different because we as humans are so variable. We're so complicated. And we are designing a somewhat analogous system or pushing for that in some ways to be even better with different variables in the moment, to be even better at problem solving, to be even better at getting these things where we aren't as good sometimes, and to always be in the moment, in flux, changing and turning and getting it better. I just see that as different from the nuclear regulations. And how do you manage that? How do you manage something that's ever evolving minute to minute to minute to just get better and better and better and better? Because if that becomes fully autonomous and it says, well, you know, this is, you know, HAL 9000 or whatever in 2001, right? He was like, oh, he knows. And all of a sudden it's like, you know what? Nothing you can do. I can hear everything you're saying in the other pod, and I'm out to kill you. You can see the fear there, right? Now, I'm not trying to fearmonger here, but I'm just saying, how do you have rules or governance for something we're by design creating to be ever changing, ever evolving, ever trying to get better? What's answer it for us, Robert? Answer it. Give us the answers.
Yeah. No, I think you make great points. And I think it's similar to the points that people make when they're thinking about designing governance systems for humans. And they're realizing that, well, you create a set of rules. You know, humans are interesting in that if you create a set of rules and the humans react to those rules. So, you know, maybe you were taking all this data from the world as it was, and then you created a set of rules, but that doesn't do it because the humans are reacting to those rules, and the world is completely different. The data that you had isn't useful for this new world of these different rules that you created because of the ways that humans react to it. And so, you know, mathematically, that we need to find what's called a fixed point. You know, you need to find the point that's kind of the end of that iterative process where you have an equilibrium, what we call a social equilibrium. And I think you're absolutely right that we need to think about a social equilibrium in a world where we have machines that are potentially acting as agents and have some resources and capabilities which are different from ours. In some cases, they may exceed our capabilities. In some cases, they may exceed in one area and be deficient in another area. But you know that's a new challenge. I think you're right. I think that is a challenge which is incredibly important and is just a little bit over the horizon right now. And thank goodness for that, Xavier.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, I'm glad it's not right in our front door right now. I'm glad for that.
Yeah. But I think you're right that we need to be thinking about that now. You know, what should the world look like when there are maybe a whole slew of autonomous agents that are out there? And what should governance arrangements look like in that world? Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of issues around that for sure.
Yeah, 100%. And you know, it's you know, if you don't know clearly, then I certainly don't know. But I think asking good questions is a start. So I guess let me ask just kind of we can fantasize a little bit based on your understanding of the data based on AI systems, et cetera. What's a framework? If you had your way, what's a framework right now? Again, this changes. You could give me a totally different answer in 6 months, so I won't hold you to it. But what would be some key things or critical things that you would say yes in terms of standards, licensing, liability, in terms of do we have an independent body to manage and regulate these things? What would be the Traeger model for international governance of AI systems as of right now? Again, subject to change, but what would you say would need to be, from everything you know, with all the variables, kind of, you know, some baseline features here, or some kind of, you know, grounding principles?
Yeah. Well, just maybe, excuse me, at a high level, you know, I think we need to develop at a technical level all of the ways that we want to be evaluating these systems to figure out if they're doing what we want them to be doing. And I think that field of model evaluation is really in its infancy. So we need to get better there. We need to invest there. AI safety institutes that have popped up in the US and the UK and are probably going to pop up in other parts of the world and a number of other countries, including, I understand, Kenya, maybe Korea, probably Europe, other places are thinking about thinking about developing an AI safety institute. Of course, the firms are thinking about this. Private firms are thinking about some of these issues. So that is developing, but is it developing fast enough? Are we investing the way that we really need to develop those model evaluations? Probably not, to be honest. Probably not. I think we could do a lot better there. When we have a set of model evaluations, then we can create a governance regime to enforce them. And we can do that domestically, and we can have regulators domestically. I think a big question that people have now is, should you have a single centralized regulator like the FDA that then goes off and performs model evaluations on companies? Or should it be more like an ecosystem where, you know, you have a lot of firms that are willing to do it? Maybe those firms get certified by some central regulator, but then the firms go off and perform the evaluations. I think there might be some reason to think that the first model is better in a case like this, but people are still debating that, and I think there's a lot of interest in that. Once you've done that, then you need to... Excuse me. Then you need to think about, well, how are you going to have a regime that makes that real internationally? That's one of the issues. So what would the Traeger model be there? I mean, I like this idea related to the paper that we wrote of a jurisdictional certification model. I think it politically is, it has some advantages because I don't think that the national security communities in, let's say, the United States, are going to allow an international regulator in to check out what OpenAI is doing and monitor and find out. I think that would be seen as kind of proliferating event that they wouldn't be comfortable with. And so I think a model where we have an international organization that checks that all these local jurisdictions have appropriate regulation and helps them when they don't. You know, that's one of the things that goes on in a regime like the International Civil Aviation regime. You know, if there's some jurisdiction that doesn't have the right regulation, the right capacity, it becomes this huge international effort to cure that defect. And you see experts from the country, like recently Kazakhstan, flying all over the place to other places to get training, and people from other places flying in to give training, and there's a real learning curve for that jurisdiction. And so I think that's the kind of thing that would be useful. I think then we need a bit of a regime to make that, you know, to give incentives internationally so that these jurisdictions are complying. And so we can talk about how that might go. One thing you could do is a tie to the trade regime. That's controversial because ties to the trade regime are always controversial. Not everybody likes that idea. So there are different things you could do. If you did a tie to the trade regime, you know, you might think about it again on analogy to the civil aviation regime. So so suppose there's a country that is in violation of ICAO standards, the civil aviation regime. The Federal Aviation Administration in the United States has the ability to prohibit flights that originate from that jurisdiction from entering U.S. airspace. So we might say something similar in the case of AI. We could say, well, if there's a jurisdiction that's in violation of international standards, then a country like the United States and others could say it's not going to import any products whose supply chains have AI from that jurisdiction. And it's not going to export to that jurisdiction any of the inputs into AI production functions. So that, I think, would give a really strong incentive for jurisdictions to comply. Not perfect, not answering every question, but probably doing a lot. Now, I have to say two other things, because you asked this. You asked a big question. Yeah. You know, a big question. Yeah. So I just have to say two other things. I'll say them very quickly. Mm-hmm. One is that I think, you know, we need ways of thinking about, well, is somebody cheating on this regime? And I think there's a lot of things that we can do with oversight and governance through computing infrastructure. So we can require, for instance, data center providers to do workload classification on things that are running on their data centers. So they can usually figure out, even without any new technical anything, they can figure out, is somebody at my data center right now? Are they training a large model? Or are they doing inference at scale? Or are they fine-tuning a large model? Those are the kinds of things that a data center provider right now has a good chance at figuring out, sort of like the way that financial firms have know your customer regimes, and they try to figure out, is somebody doing something like money laundering that they shouldn't be doing right now? And it's in part a research problem. You can have an AI model that's taking in all the data and trying to figure out, is somebody doing something that they shouldn't be doing? Are they doing something when they don't actually have the appropriate government permissions for doing that thing? So we can have some computing infrastructure oversight to try to figure out and catch when people are violating regimes. And finally, we can have liability, because that's another essential piece. We need liability for people who are violating regimes, and we need maybe criminal codes in some cases, and we need to figure out when we need liability, when we need criminal codes, and where in the value chain these things should sit. I think there is where, again, there's still a lot of debate.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, this is what's really important. I really kind of have an allergy to people that just, you know, kind of moan and groan about all the problems or anything, and they offer no maybe solutions or alternatives. So you've definitely listed out a handful there, which is, I think, I mean, again, those are great starting points. Okay. So let me, we've probably touched on this in different components, but I'll just break it up into two categories, and then I'll have a bunch of sub questions here. So the first one is, we've talked about it kind of generally, but more head on. You make this distinction in a few of your papers on, civilian AI and military AI, right? And some of these I kind of see them as like two groupings or two headings. So you can tell us about the differences and why they're important to be distinct. But I have a few kind of sub questions, a little bit more tangible. So kind of, I think, for listeners to kind of see the pieces here. So one might be, you know, with civilian AI, how are we going to be able to know what's real and what's fake? This is becoming a big problem for a lot of different things, right? Not just deep fake videos, but a lot of other things, especially now that, you know, Apple has all of our faces in their server somewhere, right? Another piece of this is, you know, what's going to happen when AI is just backed up by quantum computing? Right. This is another, you know, that's very scary, right? It's very scary. And I guess this is maybe just kind of you don't have to answer this, and maybe a little bit more, you know, kind of in the weeds here, but, you know, how does this change things like copyrights and what people are doing there in terms of like, okay, like how do, it's kind of the real fake question is, how do I know what is, you know, did this person do it? Did they not? Who gets to have the copyright for things? And I just fear, one of my fears, or one of the risks, is that, you know, we're going to become more and more and more and more siloed and more disconnected in some way, even though we'll be very connected with technology, because we'll just have everything curated for whatever our horrible biases are, or whatever it is, or stereotypes or things like that. So yeah, these are just some of the things that pop up in my head about civilian AI. So you just tell us about it, and yeah, maybe some of those or other things I haven't mentioned about some of the risks and some of the elements to consider when thinking about civilian AI.
Yeah, I mean, civilian AI is where a lot of the action is right now. You know, it's not like the nuclear case where that was developed by governments, and then, you know, some of it entered the way that governments wanted it to into civilian sectors. This is a case where it's a technology that's coming from the private sector. And so governing the civilian aspects of it is hugely important. That's where a lot of the action really is. On this distinction between civilian and military, the reason I want to make that is because I just know, as hard as it is to regulate civilian, it's even harder to regulate the military side of things. Arms control is a very tough proposition. That's something no one would disagree with, but it's even harder than the advocates for arms control realize. You can argue that we don't have a single example, not one single example. You could argue that where countries that are major powers decide they're going to limit their development of a technology with important military implications, and for which they don't have a substitute technology. So there are lots of cases that look like they're exceptions to that rule, but then when you drill down into them, they don't so much look like exceptions. So for instance, the Biological Weapons Convention, I mean, that really looks like an exception, you know, because that prohibits the development, stockpiling, use, transfer of any biological weapons. So great, you know, that looks like just the kind of thing we're after. Countries agree to it. But the first telltale sign there is that there's no provision for verification at all. So why would countries agree to something where there's no provision for verification? Well, it turns out that the Nixon administration, when it was considering this, explicitly is thinking about the military substitute. In fact, they talk about biological weapons as a poor person's nuclear weapon. In other words, the biological weapon isn't quite as good from the military point of view as a nuclear weapon, not quite as targeted, not quite as effective, harder to deliver than a nuclear weapon from the military point of view. So they say, well, why do we want everybody to have this capability that right now only this smaller set of countries has? So that's a principal reason why they are willing to sign on to the Biological Weapons Convention. And part of what is effective from their point of view is that there's a non-proliferation aspect to it. It makes it harder to have a biological weapons program. It has to be much more secret. That makes it much harder to do and more costly. So that's good from their point of view. And then, of course, the Soviet Union is violating this agreement on a massive scale. They have tens of thousands of people working on biological weapons, but it doesn't really affect things that much because, again, there's a military substitute. So the point is just that, you know, when it actually comes to these cases where there isn't a military substitute, we don't really have good examples of arms control. And so that's why we wanted to focus on the civilian side of things, because we knew that focusing on arms control for a technology that really doesn't have a military substitute, that's able to do things potentially that no other technology is able to do, that's going to be extremely challenging. It's not that we shouldn't be talking about it. It's not that there might not be things that we need to do there. But since so much of the action with this technology is going on in the civilian space, and that's easier to do, our thinking was, well, let's talk about that first and separate these conversations so that the difficulty of one doesn't hold us back from the things that we can do on the other.
Doesn't it seem, though, that both have really potentially catastrophic risks? One is just more short-term, one's more long-term. So military AI, the risks there are, you know, could be catastrophic in the short term. But the civilian AI, if it goes unregulated, unchecked, all these things, we could develop very, very highly intelligent, you know, systems or AI that could just be here way after we're here and have long-term implications. So I'm not saying that's exactly that black and white, but both have risks, different types of risks, but both have some pretty serious risks involved. Yeah.
Absolutely. They both have very significant risks involved. You know, I think we need to think about both. I do. I'm happy to talk about the military side if you want to focus on that. I think, you know, there are aspects of non-proliferation that we can do there. And thinking about non-proliferation and norms of use are really what we have in the nuclear area. And that's something that we might strive for in the AI space. And, you know, if you think about something like the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons that went through the UN General Assembly, you'll never have that treaty without the non-proliferation regime preceding it. The one really rests on the other. And I could talk about why that's likely to be the case. But, you know, non-proliferation is very controversial because it involves a club of countries that are enforcing something on others. But as in the nuclear case, I think we can probably agree that it's better that it's harder to get a hold of a nuclear weapon. And so it probably is in everyone's interest to have that sort of non-proliferation. But of course, there has to be a development component to make it remotely palatable to the whole world. There has to be a development component that goes along with that. And of course, there was in the IAEA, that was the original purpose of the IAEA, was spreading peaceful nuclear technology. So I think, you know, if we're thinking about non-proliferation, then we have to think about that as well. And that, I'm not saying that is the answer to everything. I'm just saying that's the sort of thing that, again, we have models of, and we have models of them probably for good reason.
Okay. So since we're on the military thing, I have a million questions. So let me ask a few of these here. So, yes, how do we have non-proliferation and norms of use globally? I mean, just saying that out loud sounds impossible. But how do we try for that? In two ways. In terms of when two countries are in, let's say, conflict and or war, and not when they're in conflict or in war. So here's what I mean. If another country invades another country, if another country in whatever category, you know, this is where kind of like the question we were talking about earlier, this becomes a kind of part of the like ethics or the kind of overriding general principle things that we aspire for and we hold up. And then the kind of regulatory norms of use is the more pragmatics of it. I mean, yes, if that happens and let's say there's war, right? And let's say it's a just war. I mean, my understanding is most wars are a kind of just war. There's a kind of self-defense, or there's a kind of, you know, way in which they're trying to justify for, you know, retaliation or things like that. Okay. I think there's the kind of like the two principles, right, of that whole thing of like going into war, you know, what are the causes for going into war? Okay. And then what are the things you do during the war, don't do, and kind of rules of engagement, things like that. So with weapons, with military AI, how do you have those norms of use where it's so varied, right? So if, you know, how do you say, look, that's too far, that's too much, you cannot use this, you should use this, you know, how to, you know, and then this kind of goes in both cases, you know, who's enforcing that? What are the penalties for that? You know, how does that not just lead to more conflict? That seems very difficult. In a second category, so in non-war situations, I mean, that seems more I don't know, anomalous, right? It just, you know, you have terrorist groups around the world and, you know, they do something or commit something, or potentially terrorist groups that are planning things. You get all these kinds of intel saying this, that, and the third. You know, I'm thinking in this case, I'll use somebody specifically here. A lot of people, and I understand the claims, became very upset when President Obama used many, many, many drone attacks around the world. Many drone attacks. We were very upset about this. And I understand that. I understand it because you're having one person. So in principle, right, we can talk about his character or whatever. That's another discussion. But in principle, if that's acceptable, or there are no rules for that, or there are no boundaries or guidelines, it's just like, look, this is a threat, very good intel. We're going to cross nation state lines. We're going to, you know, way up high, you can't see it, drones, boom, we're going to take them out anywhere we want. I mean, that it's a Wild West. It's a Wild West. And again, what are the penalties for that? Who enforces that? This is non-war, right? And it's not a theater of war, let's say. There hasn't been a declaration of war. So you're using, you know, I don't care how good the intel is, you're using weapons, certain types of weapons, at your discretion, based on your interest. You know, if India or Pakistan say, you know, we got some intel that there's some pretty rough characters out in Idaho, and so we just have some drones and we're just going to, you know, take them out, that would not be okay with people in the United States, right? That would not fly, right? So I guess I just see in these kind of terms of like, if two countries are in conflict or they're in war or not in war, but both of these things, there are AI systems. I mean, drones are a kind of, you know, lethal semi-autonomous weapon with pretty good accuracy, things like that. You know, how do you have norms of use or non-proliferation? Again, we're not talking about nuclear here. We're not talking about nuclear. We're talking about, you know, drones. We're talking about biochemical weapons. We're talking about certain types of rockets. We're talking about certain type, all these things. Help explain this for me. How do we have a global or international way of norms of use and non-proliferation for these types of potential military AI systems?
Well, I think the first thing is just to remind ourselves that we have that when it comes to nuclear weapons. We have a global regime on non-proliferation, and we have global norms of use when it comes to the first use of nuclear weapons. So I think it's often helpful when things look impossible to realize that, well, that has happened before. But there are particular challenges in this case, as you point to. But
that's, again, I hate doing this, right? The nuclear feels distinct. That feels like a last resort. It's like, yes, one drop wipes out a city, wipes out people, wipes out the whole area. Yeah we shouldn't. It's just the impact is crazy. Sending rockets into a town and like you could still live on another side of town and not have an impact, that feels lower stakes. I mean, it's terrible. It's awful. But that just feels different, right? Like, is that what makes it harder? You know, it's easy for the big stuff. Like,
yeah,
obviously we're not going to take a nuke and like wipe out cities. Like that's absolutely, like people are going to get on board with that. Even the bad guys, right? But like, it's much different when it's like, we'll spray a little gas here and that's fine.
Yeah.
Like it just feels different in scale, no?
Absolutely. And I think you're absolutely right. We're not going to be able to have effective norms that cover everything that we want. We're not going to be able to. Look at the cyber area right now, right?
I mean, that's a whole other area.
But the point is that's a great example it's a Wild West. You know, states are hacking left and right into everything that each other are doing. There are some things that they're not doing, right? That they're not actually causing huge infrastructure problems or something. You know, they're not using those capabilities, but they are hacking into each other's systems, taking information, and developing the ability to do all kinds of bad stuff should they ever need to do it. So there's no norm that's been able to prevent that from happening. And I think there are kind of reasons why that's the case. I don't think it's like, oh, we just need to talk about that some more and think about it harder, and then we're going to have a norm. And in the AI space, you know, one of the major issues that we have is that it's hard to know when AI has been used. You know, one of the things about a nuclear weapon is that when it is used, you're pretty sure about it. Like, okay, that thing went off. There was a big bang. And it's much easier to have a norm against first use when you know that there has been first use. But imagine the situation with AI where, you know, one side is saying, oh, well, you know, we think they did. We're not sure. We can't prove it, but we think that they used AI in this way that they've said that they wouldn't do. So maybe we should do the same thing to combat that and then just say, well, we're not doing it, but you can't actually tell that we are or that we aren't. And so you can see how norms break down very easily in those sorts of environments. So we may not be able to draw the line of the norm in just the way that we want to do it. We may have to say, okay, we're all going to abstain from a wider set of things, for instance, than what we would ideally like to say is subject to the norm, because this wider set of things is the set of things that we can actually police, that we actually know, okay, you crossed that line. So we're going to have to think creatively about what these lines should be and recognize that there are these challenges that we simply have in this space that, you know, we don't have in other spaces where we have created norms. But on the other side, it's not that there's nothing that you can do, right? You know, sometimes you don't catch a criminal, right? Criminal violates a norm, but, you know, that doesn't mean that the norm just disappears or isn't useful. And you can develop systems for trying to figure it out when somebody violates a norm. So, you know, it's all hope is not lost. That's my point. There are strategies that hopefully we can adopt, or there may be some. You know, there haven't been any strong arguments to say that we shouldn't be figuring out how to have norms in this area.
I fully agree with you. And yet there's a clear example here, right? We have someone like Assad, who, you know, the ruler, dictator of Syria, who's been killing his own people for over 12 years, right? In pretty terrible ways. And I recall, again, right, Obama's red line in the sand, right? If there's chemical weapons, I think it was sarin gas, or I don't know what it was. If there's chemical weapons used on civilians, not other military folks, you know, we'll get involved directly. And, you know, he said that happened. Clear evidence, right? And once I'm not blaming Obama necessarily, but I mean, he made the red line. He said, no, it's complicated. So my thing is like, yes, but what happens when you put regulations, you put norms of use? And again, I'm not saying you have an answer, but like, that's a clear example of like, yes, that would be a very tangible, like, we have the evidence, you used it against civilians, we told you not to do this, zero consequence, right? I don't want to say zero, but very minimal consequence, or not consequences that maybe should have been there. And to this day, he has continued to kill his own people and continues to use chemical weapons all the time. And nobody, and again, the geopolitics of this is an absolute nightmare. I get that. But this is my cynicism, so, you know, forgive me. But what's the point then of putting rules and regulations and norms of use and all these things on weapons if, yep, I don't care, I'm going to break it. And you know what? There's not going to be any consequences, so I'm just going to keep doing it. I mean, this, I mean, not to really make this very minimized or anything like that, but like, that's like the kid that you say, I'm going to put you on timeout. And if you go and you get candy from the candy jar and like they do it anyways in defiance. And it's like, oh, okay, well, that's fine. You know, whatever. Next time I'm going to do it. I promise I'm going to do it. And then they keep doing it and they never get punished. Like it just, again, I'm not trying to minimize the situation. It's absolutely grotesque and awful that people die in that way. So I'm not trying to minimize that, but it just, as an example, it just sort of kind of feels that way. I mean, how do you, what then? This kind of goes to my question of like, if you put the norms, if you put the regulations, who enforces it? How do you enforce it? How do you enforce it without war or conflict, all those things? Like what, practically, how would that work?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we have other ways of setting incentives besides just war, just bombing. And we were talking before about ties to the trade regime. And so, you know, you might say, well, we're not going to buy any products if you're not enforcing appropriate regulations. And that's exactly, by the way, what happens, you know, before we're using the example of the civil aviation. So let's use the example of the money laundering regulations that originally were developed basically to prevent drug money being laundered. And there's something called the Financial Action Task Force that works on this. They have a blacklist and a gray list that they can put jurisdictions on. And countries don't like to be on those lists. And firms, financial institutions in those countries don't like it when their countries are on those lists because it tends to raise costs for them. They can't cooperate with other financial institutions internationally in the same ways, and it raises specific costs when they're on those lists. So they tend to lobby for their own governments to get off those lists. So, you know, there are a range of things that can be done in international regimes that are short of war, that aren't just war. And I think, you know, we need to think about all of those options, but you know, but that's not to minimize the challenges that you present. It for sure is the case that sometimes attempts at fostering a norm are ineffective because no one is actually willing to do more than say we should have a norm. And no one is willing to pay the costs to make the consequences for violating that norm. So, you know, so we need, you know, it's a truism, but we need political will. Arms agreements are violated all the time. I mean, all the time. And, you know, you think about the non-proliferation regime when it came to nuclear weapons. You know, we keep returning to this, but we return to it for a reason, because it's a case where the major powers in the world made it a central pillar of their foreign policy that they were going to uphold it. If it hadn't been a central pillar of foreign policy, it wouldn't have worked. So yeah, lots of agreements get violated, lots of norms get violated, but it doesn't mean that if they really devote themselves to it, that they don't have a whole range of positive and negative incentives that they can apply.
You're saying all these things, and it just reminds me of why I would never, ever, ever get into politics myself, and certainly not geopolitics. It just sounds like such a, it's like never not a bad day, never not, you know, a headache. It is just so like, oh my gosh, it's just like so stressful even just thinking about it. It's just like, wow, it's, you know, I mean, but we need people that are really, really trying to push for this. So let me ask you two final questions. I mentioned it, so maybe we can kind of connect this with the civilian AI as well, or, you know, because I'm sure it comes up there as, you know, military too, but civilian AI. So I'm sure you're familiar with this, and we've kind of hinted at it, I guess, in some areas, but tell me what you think about this so-called alignment problem of AI, right? Of how basically, I mean, you can explain it, but how do you see the alignment problem connected with ethics and even religious ideas as well, right? In terms of, you know, whether we like it or not, you know, religious ideas and faiths and traditions and histories and et cetera do bind billions of people together around the world. So it is, there's a kind of wrinkle there. But what do you think about this alignment problem, and what does that kind of mean? I guess just generally, or kind of more of the ethical things about, you know, how we think about AI and regulating AI systems.
So the alignment problem is when we're creating powerful systems, how do we make sure that they are aligned with what humans want? Now, even when we say it like that, you know, it's clear, what do we mean by humans? Oh my goodness, mm-hmm. humans disagree all the time about what, mm-hmm. what they want. So mm-hmm. what are we talking about when we say alignment with humans? And, you know, this is one connection, I think, to ethics and religion, because ethical principles disagree, religions disagree. So whose religion, whose ethics is embodied in a powerful system? Now, these are, again, and how should we make that decision? How should we as a globe make some of these decisions potentially? These are the things that we need to figure out. Now, you know, when we talk about the reason why it's called an alignment problem is because it is a problem. It's not easy. You know, it may sound easy. Oh, yeah, you just make something that is aligned with human values.
It's terribly difficult. It sounds, as I said before, humans have so many variables, so many things. Like, that sounds like the hardest problem.
It is, I think, an extremely hard problem. I mean, yeah. How do we encapsulate everything that it is to be human, and not just any human, but a good human, the best of being human? How do we encapsulate all of that? You know, the last thing we want is like aligned with the worst of what it is to be human with some powerful system. And, you know, I think earlier this year with Bing and things, when it was, you know, doing all sorts of threatening things because it's essentially what it thought was the way that would be most likely for a system to go on based on what it had learned over the internet. You know, it had learned some not so great things about human nature on the internet. Mm-hmm. So how mm-hmm. do we create a system that isn't like that, that has learned the good things and will make the decisions, even in some cases where we have never faced a decision like that? How do we figure out, and how do we train it? You know, training the system is really hard to do. You know, you might start to train it in a way, and you know, you give it a reward every time you think it's doing the right thing. But maybe as it becomes smarter and smarter, it realizes, oh, I'm going to do something that you will think is the right thing, but it isn't actually the right thing. And you don't realize that it isn't the right thing until you give it a reward. And of course, then you've trained a system to be deceptive. So that's one of the dangers. Then there's another danger. You know, my collaborator, Michael Osborne, likes to use the metaphor of training a dog versus training a bear. He says, you know, you can train a dog with rewards. Because the reason is you have all the power in that relationship. Mm. So you train the dog and you know, every time the dog does what you want, you give the dog a treat. Now, imagine trying to train a bear under similar circumstances. And imagine that the bear sees where the treats are coming from. You know, the bear has power in this scenario, and it's just going to go to where the treats are, and it's not going to just wait for you to hand out the treats, and it may eat you in the process. So it's entirely possible that we could create systems that are very capable, that can intervene in the provision of their own reward. And that is probably one of the dangers and the difficulties in developing a really advanced system that is not just temporarily, but persistently aligned with what humans would want, even if we could solve the problem of what humans actually want.
Yeah. The last question I have for you you know, what is it that you think is the best ways of in public life or in public ways? How should we think about or talk about AI? Maybe not so much in cynical ways, but maybe also in, you know, more balanced ways or whatever. So how do we keep the conversation from being overly sensationalized, but really grounded in how do we take care of this? How do we manage this? How do we prevent risk? Yes, but also, you know, how do we look at some of the benefits too? How do you think we kind of strike that balance just generally of how we talk about it?
I think a key is we need to speak about, in many cases, we need to speak about specifics, because I think there's so many areas that are fraught, that where the public discourse is very, where the public discourse is, let's say, balkanized. Mm-hmm. And there's sides, there are camps, they're entrenched. Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks that, you know, Jan LeCun thinks that open source is essential and everything should be open sourced. Mm-hmm. And some other people are anti open source, you know. But then when you actually get down into the specifics of these conversations, you find a tremendous amount of agreement. What you find is, you know, in open source in particular, there is disagreement, but it's disagreement at the level of, you know, if there are two risks, I'm a little bit worried. I'm a little more worried about this one. Mm. And the other side is a little bit more worried about that one. Mm. But actually, everybody agrees that if you had an AI system that could develop a bioweapon, then you probably wouldn't want to open source that.
Yeah.
And everybody agrees that lots of AI should be open sourced. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think if we're talking about these things in the public domain, we have to, there maybe are a lot of incentives to emphasize differences. Mm. And good, we should be drawing differences. We should be drawing distinctions. But I think in some cases, these conversations have become so difficult because we're allowing ourselves to be put into camps that don't actually reflect the reality when we get into the details. So I think in some cases we need to get past the rhetoric and get into some of these details so that we can make progress as a world.
Yeah, no, I fully agree. I think that's terribly important. Well, Robert, this was so much fun. I appreciate you giving me your time and your energy and all of your wisdom for such an important topic, something that we all are living with and through. And hopefully we can kind of all work together in various roles and ways to try and make sure that we minimize risk and really have good flourishing for everyone. So big thanks for coming on and talking about this, and looking forward to continuing to see all of what you have to offer. So big thanks.
Thank you so much, Xavier. It was a pleasure. I was so glad to be here, and thank you for so many penetrating questions.
Absolutely.